Good morning. On today's programme, how a top Venice football club is hoping to leave its checkered past behind, and the campaign in the US to put the grandfather of Goth on a postage stamp. But first to Somalia, a country which faces a looming famine due to a prolonged drought, the worst in over a decade in the arid East African country. The United Nations has warned that hundreds of thousands of children will starve if a famine sets in. All of this comes as food and fuel prices in the country soar, leaving the population extremely vulnerable, as Sally Hayden reports now from Somalia.
I'm standing on a sandy expanse of land in southwest Somalia, and stretched out in front of me are dozens of carcasses. They are goats, lying on their sides, their legs sprawled out and mouths open where they fell. Children walking by hold their noses at the stench. A local tells me there are hundreds more in this area, dead from hunger and thirst, their bodies so emaciated that there was no point trying to take meat from them. The Horn of Africa is experiencing a crisis exacerbated by climate change, and Somalia is the worst affected country. There have been 3 failed rainy seasons, and the next is likely to fail too. 6 million people are in need of food assistance, and 81,000 are thought to already be experiencing famine. Somalis are being forced to displace themselves in search of aid. At least 745,000 are said to have left their homes because of the drought, congregating instead in urban areas where they set up small shelters made of sticks and pieces of material, and are reduced to begging for help. In several camps, I interviewed people who had walked for days, in some cases saying they buried relatives along the way. One was Mariam Abdi Mohammed, who said 2 of her 6 children died on the road, a boy and a girl. A lack of international interest and significant cuts to the UK foreign aid budget, among others, means that a UN-led humanitarian response plan is drastically underfunded. The existence of Al-Shabaab, an Islamic militant group aligned with Al-Qaeda, has also complicated matters. Al-Shabaab controls large swathes of territory and prohibits aid workers from entering. In Dullo, on Somalia's western border, the effect of drought was immediately clear. The Juba River, which separates this town from Ethiopia, had completely dried up. Local officials who held a meeting overlooking it questioned how long they can support the tens of thousands of people now flocking to their town. A lot has been hinging on goodwill and the charity of locals. In a nearby shop, a businessman gathered donations which he arranged into bags of rice, cooking oil, and other essentials. As Muslims, when one family gets something, we share it with the other family, said Shura Salad Farah, a 45-year-old, now forced to live in a displacement camp with 2 of her older relatives. The family were pastoralists. Now their herd is dead. On the sand we sat on, in 40-degree heat, she drew lines to mark each recent year of drought, 5 in total, not including the devastating 2011 famine, when 250,000 people died. She said there is no clean water and no toilets, meaning people defecate openly and disease is quickly spread. The Ukraine war has compounded problems. In a well-stocked shop in central Dullo, Farhan Ali Noor said all his prices have risen since the Ukraine war began, the biggest increase he's seen in 12 years on the job. A 3-litre carton of cooking oil has gone from €5.70 to more than €8. 25 kilos of flour was 16, now it's 18. Fuel costs have nearly doubled. And climate change, which leads to less predictable rainfalls and more extreme weather, means there is no end in sight. Somalia is said to be one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate change, with the temperature predicted to rise 3 degrees this century. In a health facility in Dullo, doctors said they were not overwhelmed yet, but they were getting close to it. "This is the worst thing I've ever encountered," said Dr. Shueb Ali, who has worked there for 2.5 years. "It's very upsetting. It's quite challenging to see." Nearby was a 15-year-old girl. Her baby, at just 12 days old, had a wrinkled face and an impossibly small body, even after 3 days in the facility. At home, there was nothing, the girl said, explaining that she could not produce milk for the baby. Doctors said they did not know if the baby would survive. Istar Mohammed Abdi sat on another bed, her malnourished 16-month-old baby on her lap. I want some assistance, she said. The drought has affected everyone. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Somalia.
Next to Venice in Italy and on the eastern tip of one of the most famous islands in the world and right beside the lapping waters of the Venetian Lagoon stands the Stadio Pier Luigi Penzo, home for more than 8 decades to the Venezia Football Club. With the former boss of the New York Stock Exchange now running the show at the Italian Serie A club, Venezia FC is determined to leave its checkered past behind, but happy nonetheless to play the long game. From Venice, Rosalind D reports.
At one end of Strada Nova in Venice, the long wide street that runs parallel to the waters of the Grand Canal and cuts a swathe through the commercial heart of the city's Canareggio district, you'll see a small glass-fronted shop tucked away on a corner. Just where this seemingly endless street opens up into the square that is Campo Sant'Apostoli. Small and elegant, and with only a few select items hung tantalisingly on a rail inside, it has all the appearance of an exclusive designer boutique rather than what it actually is. A shop selling the merchandise, largely the shirts, of Venezia Football Club. It's a snapshot, a touchstone of sorts for the club itself these days. Modern, forward-thinking, even pioneering. Yes, Venezia FC may well be languishing in dangerous relegation territory right now, in this their first season back playing in the Serie A, right up there among the cream of Italian football. But this is still a club on the up, a club with a plan. It's also a club whose American owners not only trust in it as a commercial enterprise, but also believe that they themselves, together with the players, the manager Paolo Zanetti, the club's young staff and its long-suffering fans, are all part of one big football family. If that seems all a bit too fairy-tale cosy, then believe me, you only have to spend time with club president Duncan Niederauer, former CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, and Douglas Fay, one of his fellow investors, to feel the passion that these men have for this club. There's no star mentality here, Duncan Niederauer tells me, when we sit down together for coffee in a small hotel just off the Grand Canal. He's also a man more than familiar with Ireland. From his grandmother's Killarney roots and his involvement with the American Ireland Fund, to his hosting in the New York Stock Exchange in December 2007, of the late Ayn Paisley Sr. and Martin McGuinness, on what was his very first day there as CEO. Then there's his friendship with footballer-turned-pundit Liam Brady, after whom his own son Liam is named. Niederauer and his fellow investors are not the first Americans to take the plunge into this historic club, whose Penzo Stadium has stood sentinel here on the eastern tip of the island of Venice since 1939, just a stone's throw from the waters of the lagoon. Venezia FC may well be looking to the future with their new investment. Their hugely successful international merchandising of the club's new shirts and their much improved Penzo facilities. But there is also, however, a club here with a complex past, a club whose history reflects only too well the presence of those two great Rudyard Kipling imposters, triumph and disaster. Founded in 1901, the story of Venezia FC is a tale of name changes, mergers, bus stops, promotions, relegations, huge losses, big wins, and bankruptcy. Lots of bankruptcy. It's a club, in other words, that has lived its life on a knife edge. And now, despite the new investment and the promotion a year ago to Serie A, when the city celebrated as only this carnival city can, the fans, of course, still have their quibbles. A team always known as the Arancio Nero Verde now plays in a predominantly black shirt. And as Filippo, one diehard fan, tells me, we don't like the dark shirt. Where is the green? Where is the orange? The new marketing strategy, he says, was spearheaded by a guy from New York City. his disdain is obvious. And yet, as I joined the crowds of fans walking through the city recently, all of us flocking to the Penso for the match against Udinese, there was definitely something in the air. Call it optimism. Call it hope. Call it passion. For this, the fans know, is now a club with a plan. And no more than the city of their rivals Roma, a modern, forward-thinking football club isn't built in a day either. Will Venezia exit Serie A later this month? Probably, according to fan Filippo. Will they be back? Si, he says. Yes, they will be back. Forza Venezia. For World Report, this is Rosalind D. in Venice.
Finally, to the United States and Yarmouth, Cape Cod, where a campaign has been launched to recognise the American artist Edward Gorey with a US postage stamp on his 100th birthday in 2025. Gorey was a highly unusual character who illustrated hundreds of books for authors like Samuel Beckett, T.S. Eliot and H.G. Wells, but was also a writer, puppeteer and theatre designer known to some as the grandfather of goth. As Alice Hutton now reports.
Eccentric isn't strong enough to describe Edward Gorey. The late ballet fanatic stalked the streets of 1960s and 70s New York in jeans, fur coat and a full Edwardian beard. His arrival heralded by the jingling of antique jewellery dripping from his fingers and neck. Alongside an emerging Andy Warhol, he illustrated hundreds of books. He won 2 Tony Awards for his 1977 Broadway revival of Dracula. And he created more than 100 tiny books, filled with morbid, camp, Victorian-style cross-hatch etchings, with titles like The Glorious Nosebleed, The Fatal Lozenge, and The Gashly Crumb Tinies, that dispatched children in rhyming couplets, beginning, A is for Amy who fell down the stairs, and ending, Z is for Zilla, who drank too much gin, before dying himself in 2000, age 75. Surrounded by 25,000 books, packed floor to ceiling, and leaving his fortune to animal charities in honour of his 6 cats, who infested the place with fleas. Now you may not think you've heard of Edward Gorey, but chances are you know his work. Well-known Gorey files include oddball filmmakers Wes Anderson and Tim Burton, fashion designer Anna Sui, Lemony Snicket creator Daniel Handler, and Coraline author Neil Gaiman. Yet, he's not a household name himself. Now, a campaign has been launched to recognise his work with a US celebrity postage stamp on his 100th birthday in 2025. Walking into his house one hot spring day, I step through the door of his creaky 200-year-old former sea captain's home in Yarmouth Port on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, that opened as a museum after his death. I spot the famous raccoon fur coat in one corner and a mummified hand in the other. Why has recognition taken so long? I ask Mark Deary, author of Gorey biography born to be posthumous. He's that oxymoron, a mainstream cult, he said. But to Mark, the main reason behind his lack of mainstream success is what he calls Gorey's profound queerness. The highly secretive Gorey famously rejected classification. He was a gothic writer who wasn't goth, and a children's author who didn't write for children or even like them that much. And whether he identified as LGBT+ is a fierce debate between those who consider him an asexual workaholic more interested in cats, and others, like Fun Home author Alison Bechdel, who revere what they call his work's iconic queerness, regardless of his personal preference. In 1980, Gorey told Boston magazine, "I suppose I'm gay," but that he didn't like the label and felt that he was a person before I am anything else. It's hard to deny, however, that he was deeply influenced by queer artists. Born in Chicago in 1925, the Anglophile drew on 19th century British satirists and nonsense writers, including Oscar Wilde, Lewis Carroll, and Edward Lear. His career began during the rise of McCarthyism, a highly conservative era with sanitized literature and LGBT figures considered the Lavender Menace, forcing them into lives hidden in plain sight. And there are many who feel that Gorey's transgressive work, including The Curious Sofa, a pornographic picture book that contained no nudity and where the protagonist was a couch, cost him his rightful place in the canon of US literature. As I come to the end of my tour of Gorey's house, now thankfully purged of fleas, I spot a quote of his which says, "Life is intrinsically, well, boring and dangerous at the same time. At any given moment, the floor may open up. Of course, it almost never does. That's what makes it so boring." This is Alice Hutton for World Report.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you want to listen back to the programme, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.